We're going to come back and talk about your gadget in a few minutes, but Michael is on the phone to us now. We're talking operating systems again. Michael, what's your problem?
Yeah, it's not a major problem. I think I spoke with your expert January last year how I got totally disillusioned with Microsoft Windows because of a dodgy automatic upgrade that ruined my computer. So I've gone down the freeware route. So I use Firefox, Thunderbird, and LibreOffice 5, and I find the software really excellent. What I did in June was to try and go further, and I downloaded Ubuntu. And presently I've found on my C drive Ubuntu's in my downloads folder. I've had conflicting information in that people have told me that you can't have two operating systems on the same computer. And my computer expert brother told me you would download Ubuntu to a disk. I've just got it sitting on my system. I wondered how do I open it and review it?
Okay, so I mean, this is interesting. So Ubuntu is a distribution of Linux. So Linux is this excellent operating system software. By the way, the core of Mac OS operating system is Linux. I mean, it's a lot prettier and there's all these layers on it, but at its core, it's still Linux. So there are all these different types of Linux. So they go by different names. Ubuntu is one of them. They're known as distributions. And there are different ways in which you can use the different distributions of Linux. If the disk is created in such a way that it will automatically start when you start up the machine. Oh, there we go. I'm just hoping everyone else can hear this, because otherwise I'm having a really bad day, I have to say to you. Some disks, Michael, allow you just to pop, if it's a CD just or on a USB thumb drive, just allow you to pop it onto the device, reboot it. And if your device is set up in the way that it will look for those as boot drives before it looks to the hard drive, they will then just boot off that. So you don't actually have to install them. The operating system will load from the disk directly into the RAM memory of your computer. And there you have an Ubuntu computer. Another approach is to install it and that machine become an Ubuntu machine for all time.
Right.
And the third way is to do what we alluded to before, which is a dual boot. So you can create, you split the hard drive up into two sections known as partitions. On one partition you have your Windows or whatever it is, and on the other one you have Ubuntu. And then you set it up in such a way that when you switch on that machine and it's starting up, it gives you a choice. Would you like me to be a Windows machine or would you like me to be Ubuntu? The problem with that is, first of all, you're then splitting the hard drive space between the two because they can't use the space of each one, can't use the space of the other. And it's a lot of hassle if you then decide, oh, you know, I don't want Ubuntu, I want Mint, or I want one of the other distributions. So a better way to do it is, again, it's almost like, you know, we've got synergy in this program because it's all coming together. We've mentioned before virtual machines. A better way to run a distribution of Linux such as Ubuntu might be to run it inside a virtual machine under Windows or on a Mac. So there's free virtual machine software that you can run on your PC that will enable you to experiment with it. And if you don't like it, just delete that virtual machine and create a new one, or have more than one on the hard drive and just flip between them as you wish to. So that's the way to experiment with it. You don't really want to be, you know, messing about with your boot process on your machine unless you know it's what you want to do permanently, because it takes a little bit of know-how to set up a dual boot machine, and it takes quite a bit of work to then kill that partition and put something else onto it instead. So I would say a virtual machine, at least till you know what it is you want, whether you're going to keep that distribution, whether you're going to change to another one, whether you're going to use it as well as Windows or instead of Windows, that would be the way to go. And particularly with a new operating system, Michael, it's not just the operating system you've got to learn. You have to learn about what applications are available to do what you want to do. You know, will LibreOffice run? Will the others run? How will they run? Are you happy with them? That takes some time. So this is a bit of a project, you know. And if you've got the time, it's great. Otherwise, you know, you may just want to choose another operating system and stick to it. But I hear what you're saying. The Windows 10 upgrades that auto upgraded people's machines, that did end up in the courts in the United States. And Microsoft did pay out money to at least one user that I'm aware of, because it trashed her machine and she had consequential losses. And remarkably, they paid. I was thinking they would appeal it till they were blue in the face, but they paid it.
What happened? I was advised by Microsoft on the internet to actually reload. To reset up Windows 10, and that turned out to be a reload, and I ended up losing Outlook, Excel, and Word, which is vital for, because I use my computer at home for work, and it's vital to have that, and that's why I decided to go down the LibreOffice route, and I find it very clever software in that you can save LibreOffice files as Word documents and Excel documents, so there's no problem emailing people for them to read according to my hard drive. I'm going to delete one of them because I seem to have downloaded the Ubuntu twice.
Yeah.
It's showing as a disk image file, and when I right click, I've got the option to either mount or burn disk image.
Yes, yeah. So you mount it either as a virtual CD or as a virtual drive, or you copy it onto a physical drive and then use that. I guess I'd say a number of things, Michael, that just sort of arise from what you've said. Your experience underlines how important it is to do a complete backup before doing any significant change to your computer, and certainly an operating system change. And that was one of the most, frankly, disgraceful things about what Microsoft did, because they made it so easy for users of Windows 7, 8, 8.1 just to push a button and have a completely new operating system, or in your case, not even push a button, not even ask for it, not even know what Windows 10 was. An operating system upgrade from one version of the operating system to a completely new version is a major undertaking, and it's something that has to be done with some planning.
And they still haven't learned with that, because this week there was talk about Windows 10S as well, which is a special which is coming, and not auto installing, but it's causing all sorts of little issues because it doesn't allow any software to be installed on the machine that doesn't come from
the
Microsoft.
App Store. Yeah, no,
interesting.
Exactly.
We're going to move on now. Thanks for the call. I've just got a text message here that's really interesting. We're talking all morning about virtual systems. Caller here from Devon, I think, I can't remember his name, I'm afraid, said, my whole business is run on a virtual operating system, as the system we run was made in 1993. It's absolutely crucial to my £3 million a year dairy. It works well, but it's susceptible to viruses, as happened recently. We can't modernise, as an updated system would cost over £60,000, including the handset. So a system there that does work, it's the only way it does work, by running it in a virtual system, but keeping it off the internet is crucial there. And I want to move on now, just before the news, to talk about your second gadget of the week. This is an interesting one. It's one that I've never gone down the route of thinking about buying. Why should I buy a dash cam?
Yeah, I've got two on my car.
What?
One front, one back. And if I could put a force field around it, I would. I put it on when I just saw too many cases of people being, you know, crash for cash, or collisions and other incidents being lied about by other parties. And I just think, you know, these days it's incumbent upon us to have a record of a journey that we are in control of and we're legally responsible for. There can be all sorts of safety advantages to having them as well, and we'll go into that in a moment. But I really think it's ideal to have a dash cam these days. And if you can afford, get one for the front and one for the back. I know that's a that's an investment, but it's a seriously good thing. So it's probably just worth taking a step back and saying, you know, what is a dash cam? A dash cam is a video recording device that's typically mounted to the dashboard of a car. If you've only got one, it will be facing usually forwards through your windscreen, and it will continuously record. And it does that onto a memory card. And as depending on the size of your memory card, as the memory card fills up, it will start overwriting the oldest recordings. So the one that we're looking at today is called the Transcend Drive Pro 230. So Transcend is spelled T-R-A-N-S-C-E-N-D. Drive Pro is one word, and it's a 230. Now, about a year or so ago, we reviewed the 220, and I don't think I can remember a single gadget garnering as much interest and as many questions as that machine afterwards. So there was really seem to be a thirst for these sorts of devices, but not knowing how to choose a good one. So this is a 230. Actually, it's extremely similar to the 220. If you look at most of the specs, they seem to be identical. What I notice is that the sensor is now a Sony Exmor sensor, which is a very high quality sensor, and I suspect it's got a slightly better lens on it as well, which is important because when you look at quality, it's not just about, you know, the number of pixels on the screen. There are other factors that that determine whether that number plate is visible, whether you can actually identify a person even. So this has got very good quality. It sells for about £100 if you shop around. It's new, so be careful because it looks like the 220, and the 220 is still being sold on some major retailers' websites, so be careful what you're buying. But not all webcams or dash cams rather are created equal. Some of them have some very worthwhile bells and whistles. So for example, this one has a GPS receiver in it, just like a sat nav. It has a GPS receiver in it. Why is that important? Well, because you can do a number of things with it. First of all, you can look at the route where you've been and examine the route afterwards where you've been, if that's of interest to you. But also, if there is an incident, it will be able to record what was your speed, which lane were you in, and that information gets encoded into the video footage that it shoots. So there's much more detailed information, and that's the sort of information that might make the difference between a claim going against you or going against another party, or proving your innocence. You know, that you can actually see that you weren't driving. They can show there's a record of the fact that you weren't driving erratically, your speed wasn't varying, you weren't going from lane to lane, because the GPS will allow the device to record that information. In addition, the 230 has some very interesting features. It has something called lane departure warning system. So bear in mind, this is a camera looking forward through your windscreen. So it can see the white lines. It can see when you're in the lane and when you're falling asleep and starting to veer outside the lane. And it will alert you to the fact that you're veering out of your lane.
That's the type of thing that costs thousands to get on a car, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's not the sort of thing that's easily retrofitted to a car until now. It's always also got something called a forward collision warning system. So again, if it can see the cars in front of you and other objects in front of you, if it detects that, you know, given your speed, and it knows your speed because it's got the GPS built into it, given your speed, if it thinks that you're in danger of colliding with something in front of you, then it will warn you beforehand. Now, the more advanced version of that is the modern car, where it not only warns you, but it actually takes over the brakes and starts to gradually slow you down. And, you know, that sort of thing has its benefits. But if you've got an older vehicle or one that doesn't have anything like that, that sort of system, and you can switch all this off, by the way, if you don't want it, but it's there and it's great.
I was going to say that actually I have that. It's called my mother, who sits in the car. You can't switch her off. No,
and I'm not going to start digging with you in that particular
right, okay.
hole.
So
it's also got a parking mode where it is active and looks for any movement near the car when it's parked. Now, I'm a bit ambivalent about this because it means that when your car is parked in a neighbourhood that apparently you're somewhat worried about, you've got your dash cam on full display, so that may make a tempting target. But the idea is, if anyone comes too close to your vehicle, it will start to record them straight away. And that's, it's a useful thing. It's a safeguard, again, if someone, comes up to your vehicle. it will make a recording of them. It's got a built-in battery, by the way, so you get uninterruptible recording. So even if you're involved in a crash and the battery dies, it can still carry on recording for a period of time. So no dash cam is perfect, but this one is very close to it. I've given it 4.5 stars out of 5. It's called the Transcend Drive Pro 230. As I say, I think it's a good purchase. But with all these things, if you do buy them in a way that you can return them if you don't like it, because, you know, people's expectations of these devices can be very different. By the way, it's got an app, so you can control it from the app and you can actually stream out the video as well using Wi-Fi.
But don't do that at the same time as driving.
No, don't do that at the same time as driving. No, but right. it's a sophisticated one. But I think for £100, it actually represents good value for money as well, hence the 4.5 stars. But I would buy it from one of the major retailers, perhaps online, in such a way that you get, let's say, up to 30 days or so to return it if you're not happy with it for
Excellent.
Any reason.
22 minutes to go of the tech hour, the tech second hour of the tech hours. What have I learned so far this morning? I have learned the following. Download a second browser. Really good advice. Backups, and more backups. Turn it off and turn it on again. And wait a few seconds in between, absolutely, yes. Virtual operating systems. Inside your main operating system are a really good way of running older software. A message quickly to Richard from South Shropshire, who says, you've mentioned virtual machines a lot. Please tell us the basics of creating one. Many thanks. You've got to do it in 1 minute. Can you do it?
Okay, so there's an application I think that's free called Box for Windows. There's also VMware, which is not generally free. If you're on Mac, you can use VMware or you can use Parallels. My personal preference is for Parallels, but both are good. Both have their respective strengths. And once you have that software, you can create a virtual machine, which means that you can run one operating system within another without having to choose between the two permanently or inconveniently. Parallels has a few extra tricks because it allows you to, for example, to run Windows on a Mac but still take advantage of all the Mac gestures. And I can't talk about it, but there's another big advantage to Parallels coming out soon, but that's under embargo. But let's just say it's something to do with a new feature on some of the MacBook Pros. There's something that goes along the top of the keyboard on a MacBook Pro.
Excellent.
Say no more.
Right, I think you have. okay, we've got so many messages and emails that have come in. Quick run through the ways of getting in touch with us. You can email us at upallnight@bbc.co.uk. You can call us at 08085 909 693. Calls are free from mobiles and landlines. Or you can text us. Text us charged at your standard message rate, 85058. So they're the easiest ways of getting in touch. For instance, on email, Sue in Berkshire has been in touch. Good morning. I used to use Microsoft Money to run the accounts of a small club. This was a few years ago. I need to do simple accounts and have seen money isn't available for free. So is there a free Excel spreadsheet that could just record the ins and outs and all those things that you could, and can you recommend one?
I can't, because one, I don't know one that's free, and two, I wouldn't. The problem with going for a free Excel spreadsheet is that it's really too basic for most users, unless you want to do sophisticated things with it, you know, in terms of running little programs and so forth within Excel. It's better to go for a piece of basic accounting software. Once you go down that route, I would recommend that you go for a cheap but paid for option, because accounting software has to change almost every year because of changes in tax law and so forth. But it will save you a lot of time if you get a decent piece of accounting software that can make doing your VAT returns or your annual returns more simply. Then in my opinion, that's money well spent. A lot of us end up having to hire accountants, even though we're not in quotes in business, but if we have to account for our income. And it can actually make things cheaper to have a piece of basic software. Something like QuickBooks is good, but again, that's one that's moved over to a subscription model. But the benefit of it, I guess, is that you can try it and see if you like it without having to commit a larger sum of money to it. So, but I would go that route rather than try to go free, because the free stuff just... It doesn't get well supported in all cases, because, you know, there's no money coming in to do that. If you want free, there are a plethora of sort of expenses type apps and other apps that run on, you know, iPhones and iPads and things like that you could look at, or indeed Android applications. But again, I would, for accounting software like security software, I wouldn't say pay a fortune, but I would go paid rather than free in general.
Excellent. Right. Mary's been in touch. Please, can you advise? Will a VSP app add security to an iPhone SE, which I've just bought? Which VSP app would you advise, if so? It's the first mobile phone I've ever owned, says Mary. A VSP? I've never heard of these.
No, I'm wondering if they mean a VPN, a virtual private network.
I had a look at VSP, and it seems to be, he says, getting it up on the computer now, something a little bit strange. It's a network provider application. I have no idea what this is.
I think we need a bit more information, because I'm not sure... If it's a VSP, then I can't comment, because I don't know. If it's a VPN, because just give me the question again, because it sounded like it could be a VPN.
A VSP app. Will a VSP app add security to an iPhone SE?
So,
if it was VPN,
okay. Well, I'm going to answer it as VPN, because then the answer is yes, and actually it's a good piece of advice to share. You may have noticed earlier on in this segment that I mentioned that, you know, if you connect to public Wi-Fi, don't do anything on there if you just want to test if it connects. The reason is that when you're using public Wi-Fi, be it in a coffee shop or a train station or on a train or whatever, it really is public, and it's very easy for other people who are on the same Wi-Fi network to sniff the packets of information, that's to say snoop on what you're doing and get hold of any passwords that you access or accounts that you access whilst you're doing it. It's very simple. I won't go into how it's done, but it's very simple to do. It doesn't need any real technical skill for someone to do that. And the only way to use public Wi-Fi safely, in my view, is to use VPN software. That's virtual private network, which effectively creates a, if you think of it like a tunnel between you and the server, the website that you're accessing. So the data goes back and forth through the tunnel, but anyone outside the tunnel can't see or access that flow of information. If you don't have a VPN, you're really quite vulnerable. I personally do not, unless I'm really, really desperate, do not use public Wi-Fi networks. I will try and use my own cell data rather than use public Wi-Fi. And if I do have to use it, I will use a VPN. It used to be something that was used by business people when they were dialing into their work computer, and it still is used in that way. But it now has much wider ramifications. Some people get confused. It doesn't do anything to obscure your identity. Okay, so if that's what you're after, it doesn't do that. It can make you appear to be in a different country, which can be useful if you want to access a service that isn't available. So a lot of people, for example, be careful what I say about that. I won't go too far down that line. BBC wouldn't be very happy
not
with
really,
me saying that.
No.
But a lot of people do that, and they shouldn't. It's bad. But yeah, there can be benefits to doing that. And also they're used by, people like political dissidents and journalists and so forth who again, want to be able to communicate privately. And this is one part of it. I mean, there's encryption, and, you know, Amber Rudd's had a say about that again recently. And there's a discussion that we could have about that. But essentially, I'm sorry if you are really asking me about VSP and it's my ignorance, I apologise, but I think it's still worth sharing the information about the VPNs.
Excellent. Right, this is a more simple one, I think, from Jimmy Moore in Northwich, who says, is there a way to get a reliable Wi-Fi signal fitted to a camper van?
It depends where the camper van is. Because if you've got a reliable cell signal, so your mobile phone can act as a hotspot, or you get an internet router which takes a SIM card in it, and some of them do that, like Draytech make great ones that do that, for example. Draytek. At this time of night, I can't spell Draytech. So if you've got a decent Wi-Fi cellular signal, and you have enough data on your plan, then that's a great way to do it. Otherwise, you know, you can't generate a Wi-Fi out of nothing. You're either going to have the internet plumbed in, which doesn't sound very likely if it's a camper van, or you're going to have another way of getting that data in. Once it comes in the form of a sort of 4G, you know, data flow, for example, then your phone or a specialist device can act as a Wi-Fi hotspot. And by the way, that's what a lot of people do. For example, they have a phone with its own data plan on it, and they have, let's say, a tablet, and they don't want to pay for a second SIM and a second data plan. So they pair the two together so that the tablet accesses Wi-Fi generated by the mobile phone. So the mobile phone becomes a hotspot, and then, you know, up to six or eight devices typically can access the internet at the same time. But it's not magic. You need to have a way to get the data in the first place before you disseminate it as a Wi-Fi signal.
Brilliant. Ray in Chelsea, we've already answered your question. We've been talking about VPNs just now. So that has sorted that one out. Everything has kismet, doesn't it? Everything comes round. And
I find
everything
if you talk
joins.
For long enough, eventually you answer people's questions.
You've done everything. Oh, if only it was like that in everything in life. Right, here's another one. This is Paul in Essex. I have an iPhone 5. The battery seems to be running down more quickly lately. Do you think it would be more beneficial to upgrade the phone or have Apple replace the battery?
Because it's an iPhone. So this is normal. So a mobile phone has a lithium ion battery in it. The lithium ion battery has a life, and by that I don't just mean how many hours it lasts per charge, but the number of times you can recharge it. Typically it's a few hundred. So a mobile phone battery which is used constantly would typically start to degrade well within 2 years and may become unusable within three, which makes sense if it's an iPhone 5. The problem with the iPhone 5 is I don't think it's going to be supported iOS 11.
It's the other one with the plastic back on, the 5C, isn't going to be supported as well.
So I think the 5S is all right, but not anything before it. So for that reason, and because iOS 11 is not is really worth having, because there's some real improvements in iOS 11. There's something that looks like a filing system in there at last, so you can actually start to easily swap files between applications. There are other benefits as well. I would say iOS 11 is going to be a keeper. And for that reason, I would say to you that this is an ideal point in time to get yourself a more modern device if you want to stay with Apple. You could still get a replacement battery and use it as a secondary device, either to another member of the family or so forth, but don't bear in mind you won't be able to run iOS 11 on it. And the problem with that is it's not just not being able to run iOS 11, it's that you won't be able to get security updates for the version of iOS that you are running, because Apple, unlike Microsoft, when they stop go to a new version of the operating system, from 10 to 11, they start to cut back and stop the security updates as well. So then the machine becomes somewhat unsafe to use. So for these reasons, I think that there is an amount of built-in obsolescence by Apple. Some of it is necessary, but some of it, in my view, is not strictly necessary. And it means that, the system won't be well supported, and it's the equivalent of running Windows XP. You know, Microsoft no longer support Windows XP, but Windows XP was supported for 13 years, and I think there's a big difference between 3 to 4 years and 13 years. And I think as, you know, Apple grows up as a company and it has more and more users, it's perhaps incumbent upon it to shift that balance between innovation and supporting legacy users, and I think that balance perhaps needs to shift a little bit, and I'm sure it will in time. But I'd encourage them to do that more quickly, perhaps.
Right. This again, we come across a question that links two people, James in Hull and Gabriel from Bowness, slightly linked. Could you recommend a reliable VPN app for Android, please? And James says, can you suggest a VPN app for mobiles? So in general, so maybe there's an iOS one and maybe there's an Android one.
There's no one that I would recommend because they have different benefits and different cost structures. And I would say it's one to do your own research on, to be fair with you, because there's no one that will do everything and do everything well. And it's not like I can say to you, LumaFusion, that's the one to get. It's not like that with VPNs. There are far more of them out there. What I would say is go for a reputable source, because potentially you're entrusting them with your data. But beyond that, I wouldn't recommend one in particular.
Free ones tend to be very slow, don't they?
Again, I sound like I'm trying to get people to spend money. I think there's a lot of things that you can and should do free, but there's certain things that are worth paying for. And I think, if you spend several hundred pounds on an iPhone or an Android device, potentially, it's worth, not paying a subscription necessarily, but at least paying for the software in the first instance. I think for the ones that are, they say if you don't pay for a product, you are the product.
That's a good one.
And I think that's to an extent true. So Google, for example, they seemingly give away a lot of software. The Android operating system created by Google, given free to manufacturers of phones, is a spying device. I mean, the amount of data that it feeds back to Google and other parties is huge. And then we're not talking about malware. We're talking about Google's business model being predicated on the fact that they don't sell software, they sell advertising, and the better they can target the advertising, the more money that they make. And it's a valid business model as long as you're willing to exchange a few free apps for your personal privacy.
Right. Two more questions, and then we're going to the phones again. These are linked again. I've got one on one screen and one on another screen. So the one on my left screen says, "Dear Tech Phone Dudes, I've been called many things in life. Never that. Do you think Bullguard is any good, as that's what I'm running on both my Windows 10 PCs? Cheers from Tim in Abergavenny."
It's not my preferred choice. My preferred choices would be Norton, Kaspersky, ESET. Those are the ones that I would think are the best ones to look at.
And then William in Shrewsbury asks, "Does an iMac require security software?" Oh, yes. "And if so, what would you recommend? Any advice would be very much appreciated."
Yeah, so yes, it does. Apple, until relatively recently, were telling their customers they don't need security software. I think that's been untrue for some time. Yes, it's true there are fewer viruses around on Macs, because there are fewer Macs. They're about 10% of the market at best. So, but still, I would be running a firewall. I would be running, and I do run, antivirus and anti-malware software. To me, it's a no-brainer. We live in a world where that's necessary. If it wasn't necessary 10 years ago, it sure is now.
Richard in Benfleet in Essex, on your milk round at the moment. Hope you're not driving at the same time as you're talking to us.
No.
Good. You're speaking very much along the same issues here. It's all about security today, isn't it?
I've had a laptop, or this particular laptop, for about 7 years, and all the time I've had it, and the one I had before, I've used Avast, like free software.
Yeah.
And I was hearing you saying earlier on that, it's always worth paying for security software, and I've never had a problem with Avast. The only thing I pay for on it is a VPN, which I use if I buy things or if I use my online bank account.
Yeah.
Should I ditch it and get something I pay for, or am I perfectly okay to use that?
Look, this is only an opinion, okay? Because obviously they're a very successful company, and they provide products that people like. So I can only give you my personal view on this, and it's not the BBC's view, by the way.
No.
My view is that security software is worth paying for, because you then know how they're making their money. And it's not saying anything about the producers of Avast software. I don't know exactly what their business model is, but I would rather pay someone because they're more likely to be there to support the product. They're less likely to try and utilize my information and turn it into money. And some aspects of security software are very expensive to maintain. It's not just the virus signatures that have to be kept constantly up to date, but it's also websites that are known to be unsafe, and sometimes perfectly good websites become unsafe for a period. And some of the paid software maintains a database where when you try and go to a website, it intercedes, it steps in and says, no, you don't want to go there at the moment. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. like, so those sorts of things are best and most reliably done through a paid subscription. But as I said, you can get, you know, you can get perfectly good top rate software for as little as, you know, £10 a year if you shop around and shop wisely. You know, so I don't want to defame Avast in any way. There are a lot of people who use it and are perfectly happy with it. I'm not one of them.
Richard, we've got to move on because we've got another couple of quick questions, and then I've managed to get through, well, about 50% of the calls that have come in. So thank you for time. Here's another one. Why does my Freeview picture on occasion break up? It's fine most of the time, but then it goes like a jigsaw. I live by a harbour in Northumberland. Could it be the ships that pass by the house?
Unlikely. I don't think their radar systems would affect it. Right, so a Freeview picture breaking up is usually because of poor signal. So that can be that the signal reaching your destination is in and of itself poor because, you know, you're in the shadow of a hill or something like that, so the waves can't easily get through to you. It could be that the receiver on your telly or your Freeview box is weak, or it could be that your aerial is weak. You could improve it. You could move house. That's not a great solution. You could get a better aerial and maybe stick one on the roof and use that as opposed to an indoor aerial, although some of the indoor aerials can be excellent and there are some that are better than others. Beyond that, there's also the possibility of there being interference from another source, and the most common source of interference of Freeview is the 4G mobile phone signal, and you can get filters that you put in on between your aerial lead and your TV that will filter out the 4G signals. When that happens, it's normally you see it as a burst. Yeah, so the picture will disappear for a second or two and then it will come back. If over a period of time you're seeing the picture becoming boxy, that's more likely to be a generally poor signal.
Pepsi, we've run out of time.
Sorry.
Thanks so much for everything. Next time.
You're listening to a BBC Five Live podcast.
If you like this, you might also like this.
Kermo de Mayo's film review.
If you don't know your app from your elbow, Boom Tish, here all week, tip your waitress.
To find out more about our range of podcasts, click, tap or swipe bbc.co.uk/5live.